Hi, I'm Paul Havershood, host of The Cost of Living. It's a show about money and how it shapes our lives. In big ways, like why inflation could get worse if we all make more money.
Here's the hard truth in all of this. Workers are going to have to eat that real wage loss.
And small ways, like what's the fastest way to order fast food?
That first Big Mac that comes out of the kitchen is going to the drive-thru.
Check out The Cost of Living. We're on CBC Listen or wherever you get podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
hitting them right between the iPhones, the U.S. Justice Department launches a lawsuit against Apple, accusing the company of monopolizing the smartphone market. Our guest sizes up the likelihood of taking big tech down.
No bars held. A former immigration detainee tells us what it took to make all 10 Canadian provinces agree to stop detaining new arrivals in provincial jails.
Foul tip. Dodgers superstar Shohei Ohtani isn't making headlines for playing baseball right now, but for the news, his friend and interpreter was fired amid a gambling scandal.
Innard beauty. Doctors announced the first transplant of a genetically edited pig kidney into a living man, and a member of the medical team says the patient is doing better than he could have imagined.
It's only gray matter of time. An undertaker turned Oxford researcher tells us about the hundreds of ancient brains she's been studying in an effort to learn how they've stayed intact for so long.
And rear guard action. Scientists are awestruck when sperm whales in Australia bravely defend themselves from an orca attack by voiding their voluminous bowels. As it happens, the Thursday edition, radio that knows when the going gets tough, the tough get going. It's the U.S. government's most significant challenge to Apple yet. Today, the Department of Justice and more than a dozen states sued the tech company, accusing it of violating federal antitrust laws by monopolizing the smartphone market. Here's Attorney General Merrick Garland speaking earlier today.
Over the last two decades, Apple has become one of the most valuable public companies in the world. Today, its net income exceeds the individual gross domestic product of more than 100 countries. That is in large part due to the success of the iPhone, Apple's signature smartphone product. But as our complaint alleges, Apple has maintained monopoly power in the smartphone market not simply by staying ahead of the competition on the merits, but by violating federal antitrust law. We allege that Apple has consolidated its monopoly power not by making its own products better, but by making other products worse.
Rebecca Allensworth is a professor at Vanderbilt Law School and an expert in antitrust law. We reached her in Nashville, Tennessee.
Professor, the U.S. government alleges Apple is not playing fair and also alleges that it is breaking the law. And we heard there from Merrick Garland that it's doing this by making other products worse, that it's become so successful in part because of doing that. How does the lawsuit outline what exactly Apple is alleged to have done here?
Well, Apple makes the actual products that sit on its platform worse by giving them this different treatment from, for example, iMessage gets better encryption, it gets better badges and sort of appearance on the iPhone. And then when you get a message that's not through iMessages, that's through a competing company, you know, it's slower, the image is grainy. And it does this for a whole host of competing apps on the iPhone itself. What I think is so interesting about this case is that Apple not only makes other products worse, but it actually, in the process, makes its own product worse. I think we would all pay even more for an iPhone that was fully integrated with other kinds of platforms that allowed us to freely move between ecosystems and communicate with our friends who are on Android. And that's really the touchstone of monopolization. If you're making your own product worse, you're sacrificing your customers for the sake of market share, that's monopolization.
You have an iPhone, it sounds like.
I do have an iPhone.
But, you know, as you well know, so many fans of iPhones and users, they love the way their iPhone is, as is. and whatever is happening legally or illegally behind the scenes. So how do you think consumers are going to react to this kind of suit?
Well, we love the iPhone because it's the best alternative. When it came out in whatever it was, 2007, it really was something brand new, huge change in functionality for us. And for a while, it continued to innovate in that vein. And now it's the best, at least so the argument goes in this lawsuit, not because it's continued to innovate, but because it's held down the quality of competing products. It's kind of similar to the argument made in Google where people said, well, everybody loves Google. Google's the best. And the answer is, well, yes, it is the best among the alternatives, but imagine a world in which those alternatives were allowed to thrive. Could we do something even better than Google and the iPhone?
I was looking at the documents, and the lawsuit opens with an email, what's alleged to be an email from an Apple exec, and it's describing someone using the Kindle app and says how easy it was to jump back and forth between the iPhone and an Android device, and the executive is saying that that's essentially not a good look for them. That's what's alleged here. How strong is the government's case against Apple based on what you've read?
Well, internal documents like this are important to make out the intent behind what the companies are doing. And intent to monopolize is actually an element of one of the things they're claiming, which is the attempt to monopolize. But for a regular monopolization charge, what most cases bring, and this one brings that claim too, intent is not actually an element. You don't have to show that they meant to do the monopolization. You just have to show the effect. And yet, even in those cases, it's important to show that they intended what it was, because it's hard to say after the fact whether Apple's huge because they're better or Apple's huge because they excluded. And if you have evidence like this that they were trying to exclude, then that can go a long way in any monopolization case.
Do you think that strength of the case that you're sensing, it sets it apart from the other cases we've seen from U.S. government bodies, you know, against Meta and Amazon? You mentioned the Google case, which we spoke to you about on this program before. Is it the strength that sets it apart?
So I think that this case is stronger than some of those. Namely, it's clearly stronger than the Amazon case. I think that the Google case is relatively strong, too, especially the way the evidence came out at trial. And I think that the Facebook case sort of remains to be seen, but it's also plausible. But remember that any antitrust case in America is extremely hard to win. So when I say it's a strong case, I'm not going to put it over 50% likelihood of succeeding. And the thing that I think is strong about it isn't so much the sort of damning admissions that they include from these internal documents, but just the sort of persuasiveness of their argument over and over again that Apple actually held down the quality of its own product and products that sat on that platform in the name of market share. I think that those arguments are powerful.
A spokesperson for Apple told the New York Times the lawsuit could hinder the company's ability to create the kind of technology consumers want and that it sets a, quote, dangerous precedent. How do you see the company defending itself here?
I think the company is overwhelmingly likely to argue, as it always has, that these choices to keep a walled garden, to kind of restrict free competition on the iPhone, are undertaken in the name of privacy and also this sort of end-user experience. And so this case will come down to that set of arguments. Is that more convincing than the exclusionary arguments made by the government? And also, I think, an argument about whether or not 65 to 70% of the market, which sounds like a lot, really constitutes a monopoly under the laws.
Do you think, you know, aside from the lawsuit, back to consumers for a second, do you think consumers, and all of us really, are in a different place than we were, you know, with all the hype of each model coming out, the lineups outside the stores? Do you think that that's part of the timing here as well, that the mindset of consumers and the options for consumers are changing?
I mean, I think the bloom is a bit off the rose for the iPhone and for Apple. I think that there's a sense among consumers that nothing really new and revolutionary has come down after all these, you know, the 14, the 15. You know,
they're still buying them, though. Let's be honest.
It's true. They are still buying them. Although, again, I think that comes down to lack of alternatives and the fact that a smartphone has become just a basic tool. I mean, the fact that I'm talking to you on one right now, just a basic tool for living. So I do think the time is right to point out that we can't have the same product forever. We need to open up competition in a way that brings new things to light.
What do you think that if we zoom out a little bit, the goal of the U.S. government is here? You know, you mentioned the odds of cases, even when they're strong. Why is the U.S. government taking on big tech in this way?
So the first reason that they're doing it is because they think that in general, the antitrust laws have become too soft and enforcement has become too soft on companies. And so these suits are an opportunity to move the needle in terms of the substance of antitrust law, what will be seen as unlawful. And all of these cases, including this one, push that a little bit further. And the other is just directly to do with big tech. It's just the idea that these companies have increasing power over our lives and that this is bad, that we find ourselves at the mercy, and a lot of entrepreneurs find themselves at the mercy, you know, particularly Amazon, for example, of these companies that act like gatekeepers.
Professor Allensworth, I appreciate your time.
All right, thank you.
Rebecca Allensworth is a professor at Vanderbilt Law School. We reached her in Nashville, Tennessee. The last holdout of Canada's 10 provinces has agreed to end the practice of immigration detention in its jails. Newfoundland and Labrador made the announcement last week after a 2.5-year pressure campaign by Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. But those organizations say the work is far from over. Now they're calling on Canada's federal government to put an end to the practice of migrant detention altogether. Sara Maria Gomez-Lopez is a former immigration detainee living in Vancouver, and Julia Sand is a human rights lawyer with Amnesty International. We reached her in Toronto.
Sara, I'll start with you. You and your experience were certainly part of that campaign that brought us to this point. So how does this news that all of the provinces are on board with this now, how does that news sit with you?
To me, it is a huge victory. It gives me hope in order to keep doing my job and the advocacy that I'm part of.
You came to Canada from Mexico through the United States back in 2012. You were seeking refugee protection at that time because of your work as an activist in Mexico. You've written in the past a little bit about your experience. You were here, you were in a welcome center, and then you didn't feel welcome very shortly after that. Can you describe what happened?
Yes. First, I got arrested by CBSA officers. And then I spent 2 nights in holding center on the YVR airport in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And later on, I was sent to Alouette Correctional Center for Women in Maple Ridge in B.C., and at this point, I still don't have any idea why CBSA first arrested mm-hmm. me. They came to see me in order to ask for more questions regarding my refugee claim. Mm-hmm. And I answered the questions. I always cooperate with them. And yes, once I stepped out of the premises, I got arrested.
When they approached you, did you think that was a possibility? Is that something that you braced for or prepared for? Is that what you thought your experience would be in Canada?
No, I was not ready and not prepared for being handcuffed and arrested.
Human Rights Watch reports that people in immigration detention are, quote, regularly handcuffed, shackled, and held with little to no contact with the outside world, unquote. Is that something you experienced or witnessed?
Yes, this is correct.
How long were you detained?
3 months.
A lawyer, when you finally got to see an immigration lawyer, as I understand it, they told you that there was a mistake here. You should never have been detained.
Yes, that's correct. When I first called my lawyer, the second sentence that she said was that your detention is a mistake and we are going to prove that you need to be in freedom. Mm-hmm.
Julia, I'd like to bring you in now. Is that experience, and others like it, is that common? How often are people being taken to immigration detention in this country?
Yeah, sadly, it's far too common. Canada has detained tens of thousands of people who've come to seek safety or a better life, like Sarah. And, you know, her experience of not knowing how long she'd been in there, of experiencing racist treatment is far too common.
Now that we have this news, when will the practice actually end?
So in some provinces, the practice has officially ended. So in Nova Scotia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, British Columbia, and New Brunswick, the practice of holding people in immigration detention in provincial jails has officially ended. The other five provinces will follow suit, with Newfoundland being the last province in March of next year. But there's nothing stopping the federal government or CBSA from ending that practice today. They could stop putting people in provincial jails today and take steps to end the practice of using immigration detention altogether.
Why do you think this change has happened now that all 10 have signed on?
I think it's happened because the practice is indefensible. You know, I think when people hear stories like Sarah's and others of just truly how horrific the system is, that there's really only one possible outcome, and that's to, you know, get as far away from the system as possible. And that's what the provinces have done. In the course of about 30 months, we've seen a resounding rejection of this rights-violating practice. I would say not many people are aware of the system, and so there's been a lot of education, and I think people are motivated to act when they learn about it.
Do you think that the cost, you know, what provinces were paying to do this, is part of that calculation for them as well?
Oh, it's possible. The federal government was paying per diems to the provinces for each person held per day. You know, the numbers are a bit complicated. Mm-hmm. We saw in BC, when there were higher numbers of people in detention, they were actually taking in more money than it costed, whereas as the numbers decreased, that they were actually losing money. But I think the bigger question is why Canada is spending so much money on this. For example, in New Brunswick last year, they were paying over $600 per day for every woman detained in a provincial jail there. And for just a fraction of those costs, community-based organizations can provide incredible rights-respecting tailored supports rather than violating people's human rights.
Sarah, there are, as we've heard, federal immigration detention facilities where detainees may be transferred instead of these provincial jails, but that's not what you would like to see, I know. So in your view, what is the ideal scenario?
Canada can improve alternatives to detention. There are some agencies that are already doing this work, and there might be more transitional houses that can be added to this program. And also, we are looking for to see that the federal government change this policy that is impacting people's lives. Canada is well known as a friendly country for immigrants, and Canada can give a human welcome to those that seek protection, but not incarceration.
Yes, I don't think that anyone could hear the stories of individuals and believe that anyone deserves this treatment. You know, one thing we heard throughout interviews and researching for this report was just how dehumanizing the system is. And so I think, you know, the provinces have all taken a look and made this decision. And so I think it's because it's an indefensible practice. And I think if people take the time to learn more about it and to hear the impacts of it, then they might feel differently.
I thank you both for your time.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Maria Gomez-Lopez is a former immigration detainee who works with the Denmark-based International Rehabilitation Council for Torture. Julia Sand is a human rights law and policy advisor to Amnesty International. We reached them in Vancouver and Toronto, respectively. We also reached out to the Canada Border Services Agency, which sent us a statement that reads, in part, quote, The CBSA is committed to limiting the use of detention to those difficult cases where there are serious concerns about flight risk, an individual being unidentified, or a danger to the public, and that last year the number of immigration detainees in provincial correctional facilities was the lowest it has ever been, unquote. Zombie stories are scary, due largely to their depictions of armies of reanimated corpses rampaging through our communities, trying to eat everyone's brains and what have you. But you'll be relieved to hear that such scenarios are fairly to very unlikely. In real life, zombies couldn't move around or do anything because their brains would be gone. After death, human brains decompose. Except that's not always true. Some human brains have survived in pristine condition for up to 12,000 years, even when the rest of the soft tissue on the bodies did not. Alexandra Morton Hayward has been brainstorming reasons for this because she's found 1,300 of these weirdly undecomposed brains. She's a forensic anthropologist and a doctoral student in the Department of Earth Science at Oxford University. We reached her in Oxford.
Alexandra, if someone was visiting your lab and was looking for snacks, is the fridge in your lab the right place to look?
Well, we do have 4.5 fridges, so you'd think they might be in with a good chance of a meal, but no, they are stuffed to the brim with preserved ancient brains, so it might not be a good idea to go for those ones.
Has anyone ever been surprised, or you all know what's what in there?
Well, actually, because they're human soft tissues, we do treat them as a biohazard. So right. They're all under lock and key, multiple series of locks and keys. But I have had someone ask me in the past what I think they taste like, which is the weirdest question I've ever had.
Should we be concerned about that person?
I was a little bit concerned about that person, but I think they were maybe just a teenager at the time, perhaps. So.
Let's hope that hasn't escalated to anything else. But let's talk about the fridges, what's in the fridges that are under lock and key, as you said. How many brains are in there?
We have over 570 actually here in Oxford. They're all of what we describe as the unknown type of preservation. That is, they're the only soft tissue amongst otherwise skeletonized remains. So just a brain rattling around in a skull. And we call them unknown because we have no good mechanism for how they may be preserving in deep time. So our 570, they come from all sorts of different archaeological sites across the world, and they span the last 8,000 years of human history. So a really great collection to be working on.
Yeah, 8,000 years. Well, tell us about some of the places they've been discovered. And I should say, as you were hinting at there, thousands of brains have been found, but it's what you're looking at is the fact that these were preserved when no other soft tissue survived.
That's exactly right. We identify 4,405 preserved worldwide since, at least it reported since the early 1600s. It's a huge data set. But almost a third of these, 1,300 and a little bit more than that, are preserved by this unknown mechanism. So as I mentioned, they're the only soft tissue remaining. And they are found in just the most intriguing sites. So we have your regular cemetery burials, but we also have Korean tombs. We have sunken shipwrecks. We have folks dressed in otter skins and buried in tree log coffins. We have burial in clay in Japan, swamps in Florida, just all sorts of different environments.
And what do they look like, these brains?
Oh, great question. So they're hard to miss. The brains of the unknown type tend to have a really distinctive appearance. They tend to be stained bright red or orange or yellow with surface iron oxide. So they literally look rusty. They are perfectly formed. When I show them to a neuropathologist, they just get so excited and start pointing out every brain region. But they're just shrunken. They fit really neatly in the palm of your hand, kind of like a large walnut, if you like.
So what is your thinking on this? Why do you think these brains in particular are preserved?
Are preserved. Yeah, great question. So I'm just partway through my PhD at this point. This is my first paper, and I really hope it's a springboard for all the more exciting research that's to come. But the question I really want to answer is that, why do brains preserve when other organs perish? It is so strange, but the fact that they do preserve in the absence of any other soft tissue suggests a mechanism of preservation that's unique to the nervous system. So we need to be thinking about what is unique about the nervous system in its biochemical makeup in life that could be dictating how it behaves in decay after death. And what's intriguing about the brain and the nervous system is that it has a really unusual ratio of proteins to lipids. And those proteins and those lipids are very specific types that occur more often in the brain than any other organs. And over time, those proteins and lipids can fuse together, particularly in the presence of metals like iron, which naturally accumulate in the brain during the process of aging. And that process of fusing of proteins and lipids in the presence of iron could create molecules that would be stable on geological timescales. So that's the hypothesis that we're testing.
Yeah. And when you say that they, knowing what's happened to them in death, can help inform, you know, what we know about brains in life, what kinds of practical applications or ways of helping people do you think that could have?
Absolutely. So the mechanism I just described is actually really well known in clinical neuroscience. These are processes of cross-linking with metals, particularly underpin diseases like dementia. They are maybe the end trajectory, if you like, of clinical aging trajectories. So I never thought when I set out to study ancient brains that it could have real world medical applications, but maybe, just maybe, it can help us understand brain aging in life. And of course, it can help us to shed light on past issues as well. Things like paleopathology, the study of ancient diseases, the study of health status, of diet, all sorts of different things could be answered by recovering these ancient biomolecules, these proteins and lipids from these brains.
Before your academic life, you worked as an undertaker. So did that experience make you want to study this, or did you do that knowing that you were going to follow this path?
So I loved being an undertaker. It was honestly one of the best jobs I've ever had. It was a lot of fun. It was a real privilege to work with the deceased and their families at such a vulnerable time. But what really intrigued me was decomposition, as morbid and strange as that is to say. So I knew I wanted to study it on a scientific footing, and I went back to school. I studied to be a forensic anthropologist. But it wasn't until my master's program that I stumbled across the first report of a preserved brain. I think this topic found me rather than the other way around.
Is there one brain in the hundreds that you have under lock and key that you're most fascinated to learn more about?
So the oldest in our collection is an 8,000-year-old sample from a Stone Age site in Sweden, which was mounted on a spike, the severed head mounted on a spike prior to burial in a lake bed. So it's a really harrowing story, and I would love to know more about that individual. You know, what on earth happened to them in life that they had such a traumatic end? And being the oldest, of course, it's also got that extra X factor.
Alexandra, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Neil. Thank you again.
Alexandra Morton Hayward is a forensic anthropologist and a doctoral student in earth science at the University of Oxford. We reached her in Oxford.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
In Boston, a 62-year-old man with end-stage kidney disease is recovering after receiving an organ transplant. His kidney had been failing for years, and for more than a decade, he was treated for diabetes and hypertension. Now doctors are watching his convalescence more closely than usual because of the unusual nature of his new kidney. He's the first person to receive a genetically modified kidney from a pig. Dr. Jorn Madsen is the director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Transplant Center. We reached him in Boston.
Dr. Madsen, how is the recipient, the patient, Richard Slayman, doing?
I'm happy to say that he's doing better than we could ever have imagined.
And what does that look and sound like at this stage?
It means that he's up and around, that all his metabolic parameters are normalizing. His urine output is fantastic, and he is itching to talk to the press.
Oh, well, I hope he'll put As It Happens and me at the top of that list.
Right.
We mentioned in our introduction that he is a 62-year-old. He's also black, and that is of significance in this case. Tell us why.
The significance lies in the fact that African-Americans have less access to transplantation for a number of reasons. And I think that the importance of this transplant is that pig organs represent an unlimited supply of organs. And I think that if we are able to make xenotransplantation a reality, that limited access to transplant goes away, or at least is mitigated.
How long did it take to get to this point?
I'm not exaggerating when I say 60 years. It's been a long haul, and it's involved hundreds of different scientists and physicians and surgeons around the world. And we at MGH are lucky. We attracted some of the best and brightest in the field. And MGH is the only institution in the world that's pursuing xenotransplant across all organ specialties, liver, kidney, heart, lung, and even islet cells. So we have a unique environment, and we're lucky enough to bring this all to fruition.
What did the surgical team do to make sure the organ wasn't rejected?
It's a good question. I'll just preface by saying that our human immune system react amazingly violently to pig organs. Much more violently than to a human organ. And I'll give you perspective. If we were going to use the same immunosuppressive drugs that we use every day in our human recipients of a human kidney transplant, use those instead in a human recipient of a pig transplant, that pig graft would literally turn black in 3 minutes. That's how formidable the barrier is to pig xenotransplantation. Mm-hmm. We've been able to overcome that three ways. One is by using genetically modified pig organs that are much more compatible with humans. The second is by using new monoclonal antibodies that are specifically effective in tamping down the immune response to pig tissue. And the third, and is as important way, was to test these agents and pigs extensively in experimental animal models so as to optimize the protocol that we then took to the clinic and to Mr. Slayman.
There are concerns and some controversy around procedures of this kind. As you well know, Dr. PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, have spoken out about the potential abuse of animals if there are more surgeries like this. Others say it could introduce new diseases. How do you answer those concerns?
I'll take the disease one first. We are lucky in that the company who has produced and created these genetically modified pigs have been able to eliminate through their gene editing technology, which is called CRISPR-Cas9, eliminate the genes responsible for creating the pig viruses that the community has worried about. In addition, there have been no reported evidence of any transmission of pig viruses to humans. So I don't think that is a major concern. The whole issue of the ethics of this comes down in a sense to personal beliefs. We here believe that is ethical. In fact, we believe that it's a moral obligation to use animals in an ethical way to save human lives. And it's not much more to say about it than that.
As you watch your patient, as you watch Richard Slayman, you said he's doing really well, and that's great to hear. What are the markers that you're looking for in the days ahead?
Yes. The markers are really the amount of urine he produces, and the biomarkers of the kidney function, which for the most part on a day-to-day basis is a level of creatinine in the body.
How far away do you think we are, doctor, at least your team at your hospital, from coming to a point where animal-to-human transplants become routine, even?
That's a good question. I can't answer it, but I can tell you that the most, other than this, saving this patient's life, in essence, what the success of this transplant will do is hopefully convince the FDA and the public that trials are needed in organ xenotransplantation. And it's through those trials that we'll be able to answer that question about when, if and when xenotransplantation will be a standard operating procedure in our community.
Dr. Madsen, thank you for your time.
Appreciate that.
Dr. Joran Madsen is the director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Transplant Center. He's in Boston. A moment that everyone knew was coming but was still thrilling. Shohei Ohtani making his debut for the Los Angeles Dodgers this week. As you may know, Mr. Ohtani is an enormous deal in pro baseball, which is why he signed an enormous deal last year, the most lucrative contract in Major League Baseball history, worth $700 million U.S. But today, a moment no one knew was coming. Shohei Ohtani is getting attention for a controversy that has overshadowed his first at-bat for his new team. The Los Angeles Dodgers fired the Japanese superstar's longtime interpreter and good friend, Ippei Mizuhara. Meanwhile, Mr. Ohtani's lawyers say that he's been the victim of a, quote, massive theft, and it's all connected to an alleged illegal bookmaker. Gustavo Arellano helped break the story for the Los Angeles Times. We reached him in Orange County, California.
Gustavo, the third player in all of this is Matthew Boyer, a California-based bookie currently under federal investigation. When did you first hear Shohei Ohtani was somehow involved in that investigation?
So this is a story that actually goes back years, because in Southern California, the federal, the U.S. Attorney's Office has been investigating these alleged illegal gambling rings that they've actually gotten some people convicted. So in Boyer's case, his house got raided in October. He has not been charged with anything. But at a certain point, we at the LA Times, myself and my colleagues, we heard from sources that Shohei Ohtani's name surfaced in the investigation against Boyer. And that's when we started just working the phones and trying to figure out what in what capacity.
And what did you find?
Well, so far, we made our calls to Major League Baseball, no response. The Los Angeles Dodgers, where Ohtani plays, no response. We called the U.S. Attorney's Office, no response. We finally hit up Ohtani's representatives, and they got back to us, and they said, well, this is what we found. We started talking to Ohtani's longtime translator, Ippei Mizuhara, and he was less than forthcoming with what he knew. And we didn't even know about these alleged losses, the millions of dollars, until you folks at the LA Times let us know. One thing leads to another. The Dodgers announced that Mizuhara was fired, and Ohtani's people put out a press release saying that Ohtani was a victim of their words, not ours, massive theft, and that they were going to contact the appropriate authorities.
We'll get back to that response, because there was a bit of back and forth depending on which outlet those spokespeople were speaking to. But in terms of that raid back in October and wire transfers, millions of dollars in wire transfers, allegedly $4.5 million sent from Ohtani's bank account to a bookie's operation, correct?
ESPN reports that they have documents that showed Ohtani's name and the word loan on two separate $500,000 wire transfers with Ohtani's name going to Boyer Circle. At the Los Angeles Times, what we reported is that the gambling losses incurred from whether it's Mizuhara, that's what Ohtani's camp is alleging, that the figure was in the millions of dollars. That's all we know right now.
Mizuhara and Ohtani are not just, they don't just have that professional interpreter-player relationship. They've also been friends for quite a long time.
They have, Ohtani has only employed Mizuhara as his interpreter as long as he's had his Major League Baseball career, which goes to 2018. And they first met in Japan when Ohtani was a Japanese superstar in their professional leagues. It's not just a translator relationship. Ohtani and Mizuhara play catch before games to warm up Ohtani. Recently, Ohtani's wife and Mizuhara's wife were seen together in South Korea, where the Los Angeles Dodgers recently opened the Major League Baseball season by playing against the San Diego Padres. So this is not just a professional relationship. It seems to go far deeper than that.
What is Mizuhara saying in response?
Mizuhara has not spoken to the Los Angeles Times. To ESPN, he said that yes, he had a gambling issue, and Shohei Ohtani sat down with him and did the two $500,000 wire transfers to Boyer's camp or world. Then after that, Ohtani's spokesperson disavowed the entire interview, even though they're the ones who had set it up for ESPN. And then Mizuhara comes back and says, oh, yeah, actually, Ohtani had no idea. I accept all responsibilities for my gambling losses. He did not say anything about the allegation of massive theft that Ohtani's attorneys are alleging. That came afterwards. It remains to be seen. Obviously, people want to know, why would Mizuhara say one thing and then say the complete opposite other one?
There is so much interest, and from a lot of people, love for Ohtani and his game and what he means for the Dodgers. It's certainly a lucrative contract. This is just early in this investigation, obviously, but what are you hearing from people and from fans?
People are just shocked. Whenever there's an alleged illegal gambling ring or even gambling losses with legal gambling, people make a big deal out of it. There's been many athletes over the years who have popped up both in legal and illegal gambling. But we're talking about Shohei Ohtani. Shohei Ohtani is the most prominent face of Major League Baseball, signed the most lucrative contract of all time. We have not someone who could both pitch at the excellence that he does and hit since Babe Ruth. And at least in the United States, everyone knows who Babe Ruth is, even if you're not a sports fan. That's the last time baseball had a worldwide phenomenon like Ohtani. Ohtani is one of the most prominent athletes in the world, period. So the fact that his name popped up in an federal investigation, period, that alone is going to get people talking, and that his confidant, his translator for all these years, is no longer the translator for Shohei Ohtani. That alone is a huge disruption in the life of Ohtani, and it remains to be seen what's next.
So he's been fired, Mizuhara has, but there's no allegation directly against Shohei Ohtani. We should be clear about that. But your sense of things right now?
No, 1,000%. Ohtani has never been accused of engaging in any illegal activities. Of course, the feds are not talking, but our sources have never said that. We are not claiming that at all. ESPN is not claiming that at all. All that we know right now, again, is a close translator got fired. His name was surfaced in this federal investigation. And no one else is really talking right now. But we at the LA Times, we're going to continue to do our due diligence.
Gustavo, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Gracias.
Gustavo Arellano is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. We reached him in Orange County, California. It was a classic David's versus Goliath's scenario. The Goliath-sized Davids were sperm whales, huddled together off the southern coast of Western Australia, running out of energy to fend off the Goliath-sized Goliaths, aggressive orcas waiting for the right moment to violently devour the sperm whales, like hot dog-eating legend Joey Chestnut at a hot dog-eating contest. The outcome seemed inevitable. But then the sperm whales unleashed their secret weapon and turned the tide of the battle. Sorry, I forgot a word there. I meant to say they turned the tide of the battle brown. Or, well, not brown. According to marine biologist Jenna Tucker, quote, because sperm whales' diet consists mostly of squid, they actually have this really reddish-colored poo, unquote. That was the last-ditch tactic, a rarely used stratagem that Ms. Tucker refers to as defensive defecation. Now, how it works is, well, no one has any questions about how it works. And it did work. Ms. Tucker and other scientists witnessed the whole encounter on Tuesday from a nearby tour boat. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation a big dark bubble rose from beneath the sperm whales, and very suddenly the killer whales left. She said, it was like the orcas said, nope, not worth our time. Everyone move out. So the sperm whales got out of danger by turning a dire situation into a dire... Well, you know what? None of us have any questions about how that pun ends. And the orcas must recognize that now everything has changed. This is a whole new bowel game. Ontario's basic income pilot program was supposed to be an innovative approach to reducing poverty, but its abrupt cancellation in 2018 left many participants struggling, and now thousands of them are taking the Ontario government to court. Earlier this month, a judge certified a class action lawsuit brought by 4,000 people seeking up to $200 million in damages. Dana Bowman was a participant in the pilot program and is one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. We reached her in Lindsay, Ontario.
Dana, if you think back to when you heard that this pilot program was going to be canceled, what did you think at that moment?
Why? And how come? And at the same time, devastated.
It sounds like it's still difficult for you now to think about it.
Yes, it is. Very much so. I put so much stock into being involved in the program and believed that the government of the days that they were going to keep the pilot if they got elected. Mm-hmm. And to learn that it was one of the first things cut, it was like, what happened?
Just to remind our listeners, the pilot program was launched initially in 2017. The goal was to learn how a basic income would impact people's lives. So if you earned less than $34,000, you would get $17,000 a year. Couples and people with disabilities would get a bit more money on top of that $17,000. But what made you want to get involved beyond the money, of course?
What wanted me to get involved was the fact that we were entering into a study group and they were going to collect data to measure food security, mental health, education, health. So I wanted to be part of collecting that information to see if this was a viable solution and to break down some of the stigma, because I really felt that the data would help have that conversation with people. This is something I believe that would work.
When you did get that first check, what changed? What did it allow you to do? What kinds of things were you planning?
So the first thing I did was I went and got myself government ID. And then I promptly went and got fresh food, vegetables, shopped locally at my farmer's market. I went and visited my daughter, who's an hour away. So now I could afford to take the gas to travel up to see her, babysit the kids. Well, she took her driver's ed. Once I got her where she was driving, Mine was, now I'm going to go and focus to get into college.
Were you able to do that?
No.
Everything you listed there, every single thing you listed, are things that I think you may know, many people take for granted.
Yes. Yes. And the pilot was an opportunity to break what we take for granted. It's like, I could get an education without worrying about losing my, because I am on OSP, and I wouldn't have to worry about losing my drug coverage.
You're on a disability in Ontario?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. I'm on ODSP. So I wasn't going to lose. At the time, I could lose getting my prescriptions covered. My prescription coverage can be quite costly in a month. So I just wanted to be able to have that opportunity to be able to afford my medications, to be able to do projects, and even go and have a coffee working on a project with fellow students.
What did you want to study?
Social work.
A spokesperson for the Ministry of Children, Community and Social Services told our colleagues at CBC News that they can't comment on the case because it is before the courts now. But at the time of the cancellation, the Minister of Children, Community and Social Services, Lisa McLeod, said the project was expensive and, quote, clearly not the answer for Ontario families, end quote. I'm wondering what you think of what the reason that the ministry gave, first of all, back when it was canceled.
Well, my understanding was the monies were already set aside for the pilot. Once they were elected in, now it's gone, and it somehow felt like it was anybody under $34,000 a year's fault. But I wasn't doing this for a handout. I was looking for a better quality of life, mm-hmm. and still feel strongly that it was showed that this is something that's sustainable and would work.
Mm-hmm. You use that word handout. When you hear people use that word handout, what do you say in response?
At no time was it a handout or free money. For the pilot, I was involved in doing a study and examining my life, and that was part of the pilot. At the same time, I do believe basic income is a way forward compared to what I have at this time, because there's still barriers there. Yeah. How is having $1,000, $1,400 be a handout when I can afford to eat healthy, look after my mental health, have better quality family time, volunteer time? I may not be able to work, but my time still matters and is a value.
You and the other plaintiffs are seeking up to $200 million in damages. I believe that breaks down to about $50,000 each. Does this lawsuit mean more to you? Is it about more to you than the money as well?
For me, it's not about the money. It's not about the money. I need to show that this program, I feel strongly that this would have worked. It would have shown that the quality of life would have improved for many people throughout Ontario and changed the conversation that I'm not less than because I earn less than. So for me, it was about wanting to change the dialogue for the future.
Dana, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Dana Bowman was a participant in Ontario's Basic Income Pilot Project and is part of a lawsuit filed against the Ontario government for canceling that program abruptly in 2018. We reached Ms. Bowman in Lindsay, Ontario. This spring and summer, Midwesterners in the U.S. are expecting a bundle of joy, an unfathomably enormous, writhing, buzzing bundle of joy in the form of billions of cicada nymphs burrowing up from the depths of the soil. And this year's emergence is a rare thrill indeed. Two broods of cicadas are synced up to awaken in the same year. The last time that happened was more than two centuries ago. If you find that disturbing, this is not going to help. All those billions upon billions of insects will not just be singing their sweet summer song everywhere, they will also be urinating everywhere. And a new study from Harvard University looked into the fluid dynamics of cicada urination. Now, given their size and diet, the scientists expected mere droplets, of course. But thanks to a lucky chance sighting of multiple whizzing cicadas, they now know the bugs produce surprisingly powerful jets of urine. News you can use. This reminded us of all the ways the fluid dynamics of urine have surprised us over the years, as it happens. Like in 2013, when our former host Carol Off talked to David Hu of the Georgia Institute of Technology about how long it takes animals to empty their bladders, regardless of size.
Professor Hu, whose idea was it to observe how quickly mammals urinate?
It started as a homework assignment. I have these two kids, 1-year-old and 3-year-old, and I've been changing a lot of diapers. So I asked the class, how long does it take for an elephant to empty its bladder? And that's how it started.
Uh-huh. And so did anyone know how long it takes an elephant to empty its bladder?
Some people said maybe 10 minutes, 30 minutes. I mean, it's a lot of fluid. So that's why we went over to the zoo to do these experiments.
Okay, so you came up with the law of urination.
That's right. The law of urination states that almost all mammals, so those above heavier than a kilogram, so almost all mammals that you would care about, they all urinate for the same amount of time. So the time it takes to empty their bladder is about constant. And that's surprising because the amount of fluid we're talking about varies. Like I said, a dog has a couple kilogram dog only has 100 milliliters of fluid, a half portion of a cup, whereas the elephant has three 50-liter garbage cans stored in its body. And somehow the way the bladder is designed is that no matter how much volume it has, it empties in the same amount of time.
No, come on.
Magic system.
So, okay, an elephant is emptying 150 liters of urine.
It's about a gallon per second. So imagine having this milk can coming out every single second.
No, I'm not going to imagine it. You can imagine it. And then a dog has 100 milliliters of pee.
Yeah, a small dog.
And it takes the same amount of time.
Yeah. 24 seconds for a dog and then 22 seconds for an elephant.
Okay, so, well, why is that? I mean, obviously they have equipment that is allowing the flow of the bladder to leave at the same rate then.
So there's this organ in the body that it's called the urethra, and it's a conduit between the bladder and the outside. And in the veterinary and medical literature, it's always just been called a conduit. It's just some pipe that goes from one side to the other. But we found out it has a very special function. It actually amplifies the gravitational force on the urine and the flow rate. The best way to think about it is like a bathtub. So if you fill it to the very top and open the plug, you see it starts draining very quickly. But if the bathtub is very low, it drains much slower. So it's basically the gravitational force of the fluid in your bathtub is pushing it down the drain. Now, the magic of the urethra is that it makes the bladder seem basically higher, so that essentially, instead of your bathtub being, say, 40 centimeters in height, which it is for an elephant bladder, it's about 40 centimeters. It's like opening a plug in a 40-centimeter-tall bathtub. The urethra is a meter long, so it's like having a bathtub drain that's a meter plus 40 centimeters in height, so it's draining much faster than you would expect.
An elephant's urethra is a meter long?
Yeah. And so for us, it's only 4 or 5 centimeters. But for an elephant, it's a whole meter long.
What's the difference? Did you just study male mammals, or is this also apply to female mammals?
We studied both male and female mammals. And there are differences between the genders. Especially for the male mammals, the urethra is vertical and it's sort of amplifying the force and the flow rate. But for females, it's not a lot of females. It seems like they're these sort of like cows and other animals. The urethra is actually horizontal, so fluid is is actually being pushed out more by the bladder pressure than by gravity.
So who takes longer to pee then?
I'm
just trying to determine if there's a reason why one gender spends more time in the bathroom than the other.
I think for the human, it's not we basically get the same number. As I've had discussions with my wife, that's a controversial question.
Uh-huh.
She says things like, did you even wash your hands? And things like that.
Okay.
Because it's
now,
using gravity. So
how did your students study this? Did they have to actually go and measure the flow? Did they stand there with garbage cans underneath the elephants?
So, first of all, the flow is very fast for most of the animals. We use a high-speed camera to sort of get an idea of how quickly it comes out. I think we stroke the animal in a gentle way, and then it starts urinating. And then we hold an appropriately sized bucket and sort of use that to measure the volume. So the elephants, we can't actually tell the elephants what to do. We just rely on their, like us, they store the urine overnight, and they don't like to urinate in their own cages. So they'll come out, and we basically have to catch them right at the crack of dawn when they get out of their cages.
So I guess the moral of the story is don't try to get into a peeing match with an elephant or a skunk.
That's right. Don't try to get in a peeing match with an elephant. It'll basically will definitely beat you in terms of flow rate.
All right. Well, I'm sure you've generated a lot of conversations in households listening to this. Professor, it was good to talk to you. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Carol.
Bye-bye.
From 2013, that was David Hu talking to Carol Off about his study determining the law of urination. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.